Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on our site at supchina.com, including our reported stories, editorials, and regular columns, as well as a growing library of videos and, of course, podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to China's ambitious efforts to eliminate poverty. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I am Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today I am delighted to be speaking with Isabella Weber, who is Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Isabella is the author of a truly important new book that is certainly one of the most talked about China-related books of recent months, How China Escaped Shock Therapy, The Market Reform Debate. Now, before I welcome her, let me say a few words in praise of the book just to whet your appetites and make you go out and buy the thing, because it's just so great. I have read God knows how many dissertations that have been turned into books, but this one is up there among the most singularly impressive, not just for its contributions to our understanding of what is inarguably an incredibly pivotal period in China's history, but also for just for posing and for answering a question of just such great import. But it's also impressive just for marshaling such an oceanic volume of research with so many detailed interviews. I counted a total of 51 individuals, many of them multiple interviews with the same individuals, plus a vast bibliography of primary source materials, and all, of course, the economic data that you would expect from such a study. But this is clearly the product of many, many years of very intensive study and work. Another thing that I think makes the book worthwhile, even to the non-specialist, is the way Isabella brings to bear ideas from the past, from China's pre-imperial past, from its imperial past. And often I find that to be a gimmick and it doesn't work. But in this case, you will find this indisputably relevant. I mean, it's really very compelling. And of course, she manages to build in a ton of narrative tension and real drama into this as the two sides in this consequential debate just, marshal their forces and engage one another. It makes the whole thing very readable. It's a meticulous anatomy of this decision, and I'm not going to kid you here. It's extremely complex with all sorts of different research institutes, economists of all different nationalities, very different theoretical orientations, and of course, many Chinese economists and officials, many of whose names our listeners are actually going to recognize, from later on in their careers when they are, at the controls, when they have their hands on the levers of economic power in China. And I have to confess that this aspect of it makes it, fun reading for the unalloyed China nerds like me. Crucially, the book makes a very vital contribution to our understanding of the events of April through June of 89, the year leading up this period of high inflation in 1988. So I think by examining the causes of that inflation and the austerity measures that were implemented later that year, it really helps us deepen our understanding of what caused the student-led protests that followed Huiyabang's death on April 15th, you know, leading up to, of course, the horrific spasm of violence in the wee hours of June 4th. So the book leaves the reader with a lot of questions, I think, about how relevant some of these same modes of thinking that were in contention back then remain very much live issues today when we look at the Chinese economy and the role of the state in the Chinese economy. These questions aren't just relevant as we think about China either. I mean, I think it's as we, you know, we reckon with what has come of this faith, I think that so many people around the world placed or misplaced in the last several decades in classical, liberal economic theory, neoliberalism, if you will. I will ask about all this and more with today's guest, Isabella Weber. Isabella, congratulations on the publication of this fantastic book and on the warm reception that it has received. And welcome, of course, to Seneca.
Thank you so much for having me, Kaiser. It's very humbling to hear you talk about my work in that way. Thank you.
Oh, you'll see. I mean, people who read it will find that I probably understated. Let's start, Isabella, with a very simple question and a big one. What is shock therapy and who were the economists behind the idea of shock therapy?
Yeah, so shock therapy really is a policy package that in its most standard articulation was composed of four elements. That is price liberalization that was meant to be as fast as possible, aided by macroeconomic austerity, that is tight monetary policy and fiscal restraint, and then followed up with trade liberalization and privatization. Even the most hardcore shock therapists admitted that privatization was a long and complicated process, especially given the tremendous dimensions of this task in a socialist economy, where basically all of the economy was run under public ownership before reform. So the shocking element in shock therapy was really the big bang in price liberalization that was the setting free of prices more or less overnight. And that was a paradigm that was based on the premise that short-term pain was necessary in order to achieve long-term gain. It was very much acknowledged that this initial shock, as the idea of shock therapy, of course, imported from psychology and psychiatric treatments, implies that this initial shock would be painful. But the idea was that this would be necessary in order to lay the foundations for a future better system. Now, broadly speaking, the intellectual foundations of this logic, I think, can be found in the ideas of monetarism, Milton Friedman, and so on.
Right. The Chicago School.
Yeah, Chicago School. And then, of course, most prominently in the actual transition context of Russia and Eastern Europe, Jeffrey Sachs and others. However, Jeffrey Sachs himself, of course, was not involved in China, but that same logic was around long before Jeffrey Sachs, and in fact was already promoted by Milton Friedman in Chile and in the UK.
Right, right. Where prior to the 80s had it been tried? You said Chile and the UK, Bolivia also. I mean, what I'm curious is, what was the source of confidence of so many Western economists when it came to shock therapy? You know, were they able to point to examples of command economies that had made the leap successfully because of sudden price liberalization or later on privatization or trade liberalization? So was this grounded mostly in the experience of transitioning these wartime command economies back to market economies like, you know, the United States or Germany? And was this a good basis of comparison for China?
Yeah, so I think the West German case actually was really important and was one that was repeatedly invoked, not only by Milton Friedman, but later on also by Helmut Kohl in the German context, by Zarowicz in the Polish context and so on, where basically the idea was that West Germany had transitioned after the war command economy into a market miracle, more or less overnight, through Ludwig Erhard's price liberalizations that happened in one big go in that narration. Is this a good point of comparison for the transition from socialism? I think this is questionable. I think a key difference between the West German case and, say, the Chinese case in the 1980s was that, yes, of course, under fascism, the economy had been organized in a very different form. However, big industrial companies had continued to operate as capitalist companies, profit-oriented right. capitalist players. So the backbone of the economy, even though it was organized through commands during the war, nevertheless had a very recent institutional and personal link back to straight-out capitalist and market practices, which was, of course, not the case for socialist production units in China or elsewhere at the dawn of reform.
And so I'm curious how the advocates squared this. How, I mean, surely they were aware of this difference, that China had no recent antecedent experience of an industrialized market economy anyway.
Yeah, so in mainstream textbook economics, there's relatively little consideration of institutions and the nature of institutions. So therefore, it's really all about getting prices right. So this focus on getting prices right is quite consistent with the idea that liberalizing prices overnight and thereby letting them free, thereby letting them become right by themselves would be sufficient to create a functioning market economy. So that's, I think, this rather idealist and on some level probably quite unrealistic interpretation of the Erhard reforms is grounded in a deeper theoretical logic.
And that's a consistent theme throughout your book, is just this sort of contrast between the sort of purely theoretical and then, you know, looking at the actual implementation. I mean, it's not maybe as stark and binary as I've just suggested, but that is the theme. You know, there's another book that I read fairly recently that looks at a lot of the same period, a lot of the same debates, and it's written by, of course, Julian Gewirtz, and it was a book that you actually did review. He looks at these same, you know, the debates within the Chinese leadership. He seems to emphasize what China did learn, how much was actually cribbed from the experiences of Eastern European countries as well as Western economists, where my sense is that, you know, you are arguing a little bit more about how Chinese economists did internalize some of these ideas. They also discarded others. They forged their own path. Is that a fair characterization of the difference between the two books? There are many, but and it's really interesting to sort of see this from multiple perspectives. But would you think that's a fair characterization of the difference between your book and Julian Gewirtz's book?
Yeah, I mean, I guess two points. One point is, of course, Julian's book is an incredibly important contribution and has restarted the debate on the 80s. At the same time, I think based on the interviews that I've done and the research I've done in China, his account of one side of the debate is incredibly detailed and incredibly useful. His account of the other side in the debate is very, very limited. So I think what I'm bringing to our understanding of the 80s is to foreground the tension within the reform camp and to foreground the massive confrontations amongst people who were all dedicated to the idea of marketization. Secondly, I just want to make sure that my aim with this book is not to pitch Western economists against Chinese reformers, but rather my aim is to show that different kinds of ways of thinking about economics and doing economics have been present both in the West and in China and within the Chinese reform debate of the 1980s. I think the dividing line is not really between people who are interested in the West and people who want to find Chinese roots or some such thing. Rather, I think the dividing line is between different logics of economic reform, and there are Westerners and Chinese on both sides of this divide.
So, Isabella, we were talking the other day ahead of this interview, and you shared with me some interesting reactions from some of the other economists in the field. Some of them talked about how they had, I don't know if we want to name names, but how they had been puzzled by the vehemence of debates among these people who were all ostensibly reformers. Like, you know, why are they arguing with each other so much? And it's interesting that some people sort of have privately confessed to you that they didn't pick up on the significant differences within the reform camp. And that's what your book really does, is it just sort of brings those out into the open. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the state of it? I think maybe one way to put this would be, Isabella, was there a conventional wisdom about China's economic reforms that you were seeking to displace or to force a reconsideration of when you began your work?
Yeah, I think that very broadly speaking, a lot of the thinking about the 1980s has been framed in terms of the transition from socialism to capitalism and in terms of a struggle between conservatives and reformers. Now, of course, there was a transition from socialism to capitalism, and there was a struggle between reformers and conservatives, if you want to label them conservatives. I'm not entirely satisfied with that label for the Chinese context. But anyways, let's just stick with this for simplicity. However, I think what I'm trying to show in the book is that beneath this big binary, there was a struggle within the market reform camp that might be just as consequential, because if we look at the different outcomes of transition across countries, we find that the ways in which countries have transitioned to the market actually matters. So it's not just market yes or no, but it's how to transition towards markets that can make a huge difference in terms of the outcomes.
Right.
Now, within China, as it so happens, in the 80s, those who were arguing against shock therapy actually ended up losing out in 89. So in the 90s, and in the ways in which this history has been written, their side generally has been not portrayed as prominently as I think it should have been. At the same time, for those who stood at the more radical side of market reforms, it was, of course, also quite convenient to own the 1980s and to own the legacy of successful reforms. So therefore, this very severe split of the 1980s, I think, has been studied much less than its importance would imply.
I think a lot of people would recognize some irony in the fact that the people who were championing more radical economic reforms were the winners after 89. They emerged on top, whereas the putative conservatives, you know, the people who... Well, I mean, I wouldn't call them conservatives. I wouldn't use that label, but people who wanted to, you know, you use this great metaphor, sort of this Jenga metaphor, right? Who didn't want to tear down the edifice and build it anew, but rather to pull out the pieces that could be pulled out and stack them on top and sort of grow the new system from the old rather than destroying the old system. How it is that these most radical reformers, the ones who you would think would be more aligned with the political liberalizers, were actually the ones who emerged on top. And we'll get to 89, but I think that's a good foretaste of that. You know, you use the word escaped in the title of your book, How China Escaped Shock Therapy. It's a normative word. There's implications in there, of course, that, you know, shock therapy would have been bad. And I think you make the case well that, you know, there are many examples of failed shock therapy that are meaningful comparisons with China. But some of them happen afterward. You know, you have post-Soviet Europe, mostly post-Soviet Eastern Europe. So, you know, Perestroika, which began contemporaneously with the debates that you detail, wasn't shock therapy. You know, it was sort of more of a gradualism. But, you know, Russia escaped shock therapy too, at least for a while until 91. Can you talk about your choice of this word escape?
Yeah. Before I get into that, I would like to expand on the Jenga metaphor a little bit, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure, sure.
So just to be sure, on my mind, there basically are three camps in the 1980s. There are those people who predominantly want to preserve the Jenga tower in its current form, not manifest it and freeze it, but preserve it as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Then there are people who think you need to basically tear down the whole Jenga tower and have the market emerge like Phoenix from the ashes out of this torn down old building. And then in the middle, there are people who think that you should play the game of Jenga as you are playing the game of Jenga, that is removing the stones or sticks or blocks or whatever you want to call them that are loosest first, and then move them on top and thereby change the structure of the Jenga tower. Now, of course, as we all know, if we play the game of Jenga, eventually the tower will collapse. So the idea is not to leave the spots that where something has been removed empty, but rather that in these empty spots, a new dynamic, namely the market dynamic, will emerge and therefore re-stabilize the tower, but also create an entirely new system that is based on a different kind of logic.
Right.
Now, to your question on escape and shock therapy. So in the title, basically, there are two terms that need explanation, right? We have already talked about shock therapy. I've used shock therapy as the reference, even though in the 1980s, the term shock therapy was not yet dominant or prominent in China's own debates.
They call it 配套, right? 配套改革, right?
Yes, so package reform, the idea of creating a blueprint for reform and then implementing that blueprint in a more or less planned fashion and as fast as possible. Now, in the interviews that I've led, many people have attributed this Peitaugeige, the idea of a package reform, to shock therapy. So there is a link from the perspective of those who were involved retrospectively.
Sure.
But I think there's also a very clear logical link where the kind of policy measures that were being debated basically followed the same kind of economics and the same kind of logic as shock therapy as it was implemented in other socialist countries shortly after. In particular, the book is really focused on price reform and the question of whether or not to implement a big bang in price reform, which, as I've tried to explain in my first answer to the question of what is shock therapy, was thought of as the critical first shocking element in shock therapy that would shock an old undesirable system into a new kind of system, a market equilibrium. Now, to the question of escape, well, it is, of course, a question of debate whether in the 1980s, shock therapy, or to be more precise, a big bang in price reform, would have been problematic for the further success of reform. And on some level, by using escape in the title, I, of course, imply that implementing shock therapy in the 1980s, or to be more precise, implementing a big bang in the 1980s, would have had negative economic consequences, or would have been likely to produce negative economic outcomes, and in particular, to probably have resulted in quite rapid inflation that would have had the potential to undermine the reform project.
Right.
On some sense, I think that the events of 1988 and 1989 provide some proof in that direction. But more fundamentally, it seems to me that most cases that we can study where such rapid price liberalizations were implemented, the outcomes were quite negative. And in fact, this even applies to the West German case that has been heralded by the shock therapists as this miraculous instantaneous success of the creation of a free market economy. But if you read the German language economic history literature on Erhard's price liberalizations, you will find that they, first of all, did not include some key prices in production consumption. Secondly, that they were followed by a pretty high inflation. And thirdly, that they did unleash such wide-ranging social protests that a first general strike happened that was really a general strike against the reinstatement of a market economy in West Germany. So that is to say that far from being an instantaneous miracle or a smooth sail, even the example that is most widely cited as the anecdotal proof for the possibility of creating a successful market economy overnight actually was a pretty bumpy.
The Chinese actually pick up on this later. I mean, when they reevaluate, you know, the Earhart miracle, and, you know, and just sort of in the nick of time too, to head off package reforms in 1986. So, you know, what I want to do, Isabella, is I want to dive into some of this really fascinating discussion that you open your book with about history. I'm going back quite far. I think a lot of readers would be very surprised that the first full chapter of your book starts with a discussion of the Guanzi, which is, you know, a Warring States era text. There wasn't probably an individual called Guanzi. You know, he's like a confabulation like so many of the other ones are, Laozi and so forth. But and of the debates on salt and iron during the Han Dynasty, during the Western Han. My sense was that these are included to suggest that in the Chinese context, the idea that the state not only, you know, has an important and ethically justifiable role to play in the regulation of prices through, you know, buying grain, say, in the fall and providing grain in the spring to try to counteract, you know, your seasonality in grain prices, just that's dictated by the planting and harvesting cycle. It also has an economically beneficial role to play. It's not just an ethical one, but an economically beneficial one. I wonder, though, whether there was anything that you came across that by way of explicit reference to the Guanzi or to the discourses on salt and iron or the ever normal granaries or any of these other institutions, or was it, are you suggesting something that was more subconscious?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So why I started to try to understand traditions in China's statecraft of regulating prices and thinking and practicing the relationship between states and markets was prompted by the interviews where people were telling me that when they were thinking about reform in the early 80s, they also engaged in what they called civilizational studies and the attempt to try to understand what China was in the 1980s in relation to its long history. Now, this is not trying to argue for some sort of eternal Confucian wisdom that has predetermined Chinese fate. In fact, quite to the contrary, by foregrounding debate and by foregrounding that the 1980s was a moment of genuine openness where things could have gone otherwise. I'm trying to counter such a reading. However, at the same time, I think it's important to acknowledge that thinking and theorizing markets was not something alien to China or something that China had to, in its entirety, import from Western economics or Western traditions of the history of economic thought, of thinking about prices and markets. So in that context, I found it important to relate the 1980s to China's own recurring controversies over the relationship between states and markets, and thereby emphasizing that within China's own history, there has been repeated struggles over this question. So there's no such thing as a monolithic Chinese tradition that then is being revived in the 80s. But at the same time, the debate in the 1980s is in some sense a debate that happens in a very long sequence of redefinitions of relations between state and market. In terms of a more direct link, I think the revolutionary struggle and the immediate post-liberation years are very important. In my interviews with World Bank officials and also in the notes of World Bank officials, they actually brought that up. And in one of the minutes on an extended conversation between the World Bank mission and high-ranking Chinese economists, one of the World Bank officials notes, "Why do the Chinese respond to every question about market reform that we have to go back to the post-liberation techniques?" So there was this very clear reference that was brought to the World Bank to the experience of the immediate post-revolutionary years.
Right.
Now, during the 1940s and immediately after the revolution, one of the biggest challenges in the economic sphere that China faced was, of course, hyperinflation. And that hyperinflation was, to some extent, an expression of the disintegration of the national economy itself. So farmers or peasants or whatever you want to call them, were reverting to subsistence production, where in some sense withdrawing from the previously more integrated national economy, so that the communists managed not least to stabilize prices in the base areas by recreating commercial links, especially for essential goods such as salt, grain, iron, and so on, and thereby stabilizing the value of money by making sure that money could buy essential goods. Now, this logic of seeing the value of money in terms of the value of essential goods, I think is one that is really quite prevalent in the Guanzi and is quite prevalent in Chinese statecraft thinking, but is also inherent in the institution of the economic granary that, of course, has a very, very long institutional history, where the idea of the granaries is that since the agricultural cycle produces inherently unstable prices, where prices during harvest and fall would be low because the market is suddenly flooded with grain, but then prices would be rising until the moment just before harvest, so that if you leave the market to be a free, unregulated market, what you would get is inherent price cycles and private merchants that exploit these price fluctuations and therefore benefit at the expense both of the peasants and the urban population.
Right.
Now, what the public granaries did was that they basically added to demand in fall and added to supply before harvest, and thereby stabilized the supply-demand relationship over the agricultural cycle, and thereby stabilize prices, thereby stabilize the relationship between the countryside and the urban centers, and thereby ultimately also stabilize the value of money. So the value of money is thought of in terms of
how much grain you can buy.
Yeah. And that same logic of stabilizing the value of money by making sure that money can buy grain and salt and iron and other essential goods for consumption and production, I think is clearly in operation in the economic warfare practices of the 1940s. And in fact, someone like Xue Mutiao would have done extensive research on the history of agriculture in that period, but going back centuries. So clearly they were aware of these practices of the ever-normal granary. I mean, I think there can be little
doubt. Oh, for sure, for sure. They also seem to be aware of this Guanxian principle of this, you know, controlling the heavy or essential and letting go of the light, the zhong and the qing, which is, you know, a kind of yin-yang dualist idea, but it has an obvious, you know, economic manifestation, which is, you know, what is heavy are essentials. I mean, things that you've already talked about. But in the modern context, those would be producer goods, right? I mean, we're talking about raw materials inputs. You know, we're talking about fuel, and we're talking about iron and other metals, coke and coal and things like that. So that idea does seem to have been explicitly invoked. I mean, I see it. You know, the heavy and the light.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thinking in terms of heavy and light, and thinking in terms of the relational importance, I think, is something that we can observe throughout the 80s reform debates, and that we can in some sense observe in Chinese economic policy making until today, where I think it's important to recognize that heavy and light is not static. It's not like one thing is always heavy or always light. If you have a sequence of bumper harvests and you are completely flooded with grain, then grain might actually, even though it is one of the most essential consumption goods, might actually become much lighter than it would be if you have a bad harvest. Similarly, if you think about this in terms of the reform period, the most important large-scale steel factories would be absolutely heavy, right? Your small village furnace that might never have produced efficiently and that always only produced for one very local market, very poor quality steel, is not essential for the working of the system as a whole, right? So even within one good, there can be, and at one moment in time, there can be things that can be heavy or light, depending on who is producing them, under what conditions, for whom, for which market, and so on. And I think this does give us a lens of thinking about economic relations that is quite different and that is, in some sense, quite timely, since in the context of COVID, we suddenly all ask ourselves, what is essential? Which is the question of what is heavy, right?
What is heavy, exactly. I have to say, I mean, the whole debate on, say, on iron and salt after the death of Han Wudi, who reigned in the 2nd century BC, it has kind of irresistible parallels to the very period that you're studying. I mean, down to the way that the factions formed. I mean, on the one hand, like, you have these counterparts to the intellectuals of the 80s back in the 2nd century BC with these literati who were the ones who were kind of championing the neoliberal position, kind of arguing against the more statists, the merchant bureaucrats and people like, Song Huyang. And it reminds me also of early U.S. history, where you have these sort of Jeffersonian anti-federalists who are in the role of these kind of Han literati fighting against, your Alexander Hamiltons. Very, very interesting parallels, I thought.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring up the U.S. history. Again, my point is not that there's something essentialist about China, but rather that these kind of debates, these controversies over redefining the relationship between the state and the market and the degree to which the state is an active participant in the market are recurring debates that happen in different contexts. In the book, I also delve into the Second World War, which is, of course, another economic reference that suddenly became extremely timely during COVID, where everybody started talking about the war economy. But in that context, you also have the question of how do we redefine the relationships between the state and the market under the premises of war? And then after the war, how do you go back from a more or less planned war economy to a more market-based economy? In that context, you also have an opposition of people who are arguing for an activist state and people who are arguing for a very sudden withdrawal of the state and adhering to an ideal of a as strict as possible separation between state and market.
Right. So before we get into how the reformers of the 80s sought to liberalize the price system, let's talk about how the central planners set prices during the Mao years. I mean, price setting under Mao didn't actually rely on the kind of state market participation that we were talking about. It's actually just straight up command economics, a very different situation. So what was the mechanism, if you had to describe it succinctly? How did prices get set during Mao's time?
Yeah, I mean, we still have a hierarchy of importance in terms of the price setting mechanisms. So the most essential goods would be, in terms of consumption and production, would be in tier one and would be set by the highest up authorities and would also be controlled most tightly by the planning authorities. And then you have several other tiers below that tier one, where you have lower level administrative entities setting the prices. And for the lowest level, it's still a publicly determined, I mean, state set price, if you want so, but there's somewhat more leeway for at least, I mean, that changes over time and so on, but there's somewhat more leeway for a peripheral emergence of markets. Now, it's important to remember that the prices during the Mao era were set in a way not to incentivize individual production units, but rather to redistribute across the system. Most prominently, right. Redistribute from the countryside to the urban industrial economy, which has been called squeezing the peasants, basically through the so-called price scissors, where the countryside would have to deliver quotas of agricultural goods at a price that was set systematically below production costs, or at least below what below any kind of notion of value. Whereas reversely, in particular, urban consumption goods were priced consciously above any notion of production costs or values, so that you had a form of planned unequal exchange where
right.
Every hour of work of a peasant would exchange against, let's say, I mean, I'm making this number up, but let's say only 45 minutes of work of an urban worker, so that you always have a redistribution from the countryside to the urban industrial economy, which was meant to finance the industrialization project. At the same time, you also have a redistribution across industrial sectors, and you have the prices of the most upstream, most essential production goods set in a way that they tend to be below cost in order to actually subsidize the building up of industries that are further downstream, whereas at the same time, the goods that were considered luxury goods at the time, such as bicycles, wristwatches, radios, and so on, were priced above cost. Now, this had the function that I just illustrated in relation to the countryside, but it also had a function where having these goods that were priced very high could be used in a way to extract liquidity from the system, where if people right. start buying quote-unquote luxury goods that are very expensive, then
bicycles and watches. Right.
Yeah, then they would be giving up a certain part of their liquidity. So that was a way to extract liquidity and overcome the problem of price pressures that is to some extent inherent in attempts at very fast industrialization.
Right. So many economists were struggled against during the Cultural Revolution. What was the state of the discipline of economics in China at the time of Mao's death? I mean, you talk about this sense among China's economists of a need to, you know, to sort of take makeup classes, right?
Actually, just as a reference that I only mentioned in passing in the book, but that I think is quite interesting, the first American delegation of economists to China after the Nixon visit was a delegation of radical economists, and I've also written a right. paper on that, and they were touring China, and we're also meeting some economists, but we're quite shocked by how empty and inactive the research institutes were at the time, which of course has to do with the fact that economics as a discipline was more or less canceled during the Cultural Revolution. The most prominent and important economists were sent to May 4th schools or sent to the countryside for manual labor. Some were imprisoned, like Wu Jun and so on. So that the institutions of economic research were really shattered, and that the beginning of reform, when economics was allegedly put in command, as opposed to politics in command during the Cultural Revolution, there was not much economics as an academic discipline to speak of. So you had that contradiction of economics being elevated to the most important academic discipline while being institutionally and practically quite non-existent to begin with. Of course, it was very quickly reestablished. People returned to their institutes. Many people also continued to be active during the years of the Cultural Revolution under the radar, so they could very quickly publish things that they had written in the years before. However,
well, they weren't slopping pigs or whatever.
Yes, yeah. So the question of how productive one can be is an interesting one. But yeah.
So, you know, what I find really interesting is, like, as you say, the kind of conventional wisdom on the early 80s is that you had these reformers pitted against these conservatives, people who didn't want to change them. I mean, people think of, you know, of Hua Guofeng and the whatevers and all that stuff. But I think in your interviews with the actual economists and the officials, you find that the sense of an urgency of a need for reform was pretty universal. It wasn't just the result of ideological battles or theoretical insights, but it was just plain old imperative. You know, it was just a matter not of whether to implement reforms, but how to, what kinds of reforms to implement. And I think people who later on become kind of tagged as hardliners in the 90s, like Deng Liqun and Chen Yun, they were actually quite forceful proponents of reform in the late 70s and the early 80s. Can you talk about this consensus on the need for reform and how complete was it? You know, was there anyone left who was just sort of standing astride this and saying, no, we go stay with central planning completely?
I mean, I, of course, interviewed the reform economists, right?
So yeah, that's true. That's true.
I do have a biased sample. But within this camp of reform economists, there were very different views about how to reform. And there was consensus about the need for reform. And I think this has quite tangible material reasons, which lie in the fact that, of course, by the late 1970s, the ideal of late Maoism and the whole approach that came with that was long dead and over. Hua Guofeng had attempted another Soviet-style big push industrialization with a 10-year plan that was this time meant to be financed with petroleum exports and fueled with imports of foreign technology. However, the projections of petroleum that had been made turned out to not be realistic, so that this idea of pushing ahead with foreign technology would only have been possible at the cost of dangerous foreign indebtedness, which then pretty quickly led that program to run out of steam. So that you were in a situation where two major programs had just like really arrived in a major deadlock. And the question of what to do now and what to do next was one that was really, really on the top of the agenda. And that was, I think, a material imperative. And on top of it, I mean, you had a situation where peasants in South China started to flee to quote-unquote imperialist capitalist Hong Kong because they hoped for a better life there. Whereas the ambition of the revolution had, of course, always been more than only material progress, but material progress and improving the lives of the masses has always been part of that ambition of the revolution. So someone like Chen Yun at the CCP work conference of 1978, so in the pivotal year of 1978, is quoted to have said that if we don't resolve the problem of clothing and feeding the still large numbers of peasants that are underfed and not well clothed, we will face a situation where local cadres will be leading the peasants to the gates of the cities, demanding food and better living conditions. So there's a clear sense of urgency, not only in an abstract sense of wanting more economic growth or higher GDP numbers, something like that, but a very
just
clear
to put
sense
clothes
of,
on
of,
people's backs. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so many reform economists have been saying that for them, the question of reform in the very early years was really a question of clothing and feeding the people in more satisfactory way. This is not to say that there hasn't been, I mean, of course, there was a dreadful and horrifying famine under Mao, no question about that. But it's not to say that there was not some degree of progress under Mao, right? I mean, of course, there was progress in basic industrialization, education, health, and so on. As one of the World Bank officials in one of the interviews was saying, you did see poverty in China, but the kind of poverty that you saw in China in the late 70s, early 80s, unlike India, was not the kind of poverty that wouldn't let you sleep in your hotel at night, meaning that it was poverty, but it was not the kind of ugly poverty ridden with diseases and appalling sanitary conditions and all of that.
So I think anyone that's even glancingly familiar with China's early steps toward reform is aware of the household responsibility system, of this idea of disposal of surplus, this basic principle. It was pioneered in rural areas in Anhui province and in Sichuan. Perhaps, though, I think it would be a good reminder, just to very, very briefly remind people of how that worked and how key that was.
Yeah, so I think the household responsibility system is important in setting a pattern for reform in several ways. First of all, you mentioned Anhui province and the pioneering actions there. There were, of course, also other sites of early experimentation. These early experimentations really happened in counties that were not the major grain producers for the national system. So often they were even net receivers of grain and agricultural transfers. So that they were not essential or heavy, if you want to use that language, for the national grain system. So some of the people who were involved in the early agricultural reforms were telling me that to some degree, letting these experiments happen was actually a step of giving up on trying to tell them what to do and hoping that maybe that would improve the situation for some of the poorest communities. Now, what happened was basically that the responsibility for production was moved from the production team to the households, where the idea was that as long as every household would deliver their share in the quota, they could, beyond producing their share in the quota, produce for the market and produce whatever and however much they want and sell it at market prices. Now, this resulted in the so-called dual-track system, where households were producing for the plan, that is, producing their share in the quota, while at the same time producing for the market.
For the market as well. So it very much closely parallels what ends up happening during, you know, the actual implementation of broader reforms. A theme that you sound again and again in your book is how the CCP leadership really understood just all too well how hyperinflation in the waning years of the KMT rule had just eroded KMT legitimacy, had just lost the KMT popular support. And even the very ardent liberalizers like Zhao Ziyang, they feared inflation as a result of price liberalization. So how deep was this fear? I mean, did this run pretty consistently through this group of reformers, or were there people who were sort of fearless in the face of inflation, or were willing to accept pretty substantial inflation as the price to pay for price liberalization?
There was a camp of economists emerging that thought that a temporary inflation would be a price to pay for transitioning to the market. But I think on the part of officials and the leadership in particular, there was an acute awareness of the importance of prices for political and social stability, and not only the general price level. When we talk about inflation, we typically think about the movement of some consumer price index that would take a basket of commodities and look how the prices of this basket as a whole are moving, right? But there was also an acute awareness around the changes in prices of so-called heavy goods. And the important goods could be quite small goods indeed. So for example, there was a debate around changing the price for matches. Now, if we think about matches, we think like, oh, this is an extremely cheap good and one that we really don't care much whether the price of matches goes up 10 or 20% or not, right? But we have to remember that in China in the early 80s, people were still predominantly cooking and also in the countryside, of course, heating with wood stoves and fire. So matches was an absolute staple in their consumption basket. And given just how poor the country still was, the price of matches would actually possibly arouse quite a lot of resistance. So again, to illustrate, to quote from one of the World Bank notes, there is this observation by one of the people after a number of days of meetings and discussions, where the person is noting down the communist dictator who cannot change the price of matches by 2 cents.
Wow.
So so there is an acute awareness of the importance of price changes for people's lives and also of the psychology of price changes.
Speaking of World Bank notes and the taking of notes, there were some really important meetings, you know, the Morganshan World Bank meetings later on, the Morganshan Youth Conference, which was all Chinese people, but also this Yangtze cruise on this this ship, the Bashan, in the all taking place in the early 80s. Your book has these fantastically detailed accounts that come from the participants, both the foreigners and the Chinese. What strikes me in this, and again, that's a theme in your book, is it seems like the Chinese aren't the ones who are ideologically rigid here. The ones who seem to be ideologically rigid often are these Eastern European emigres, you know, your Bruce and your Struminsky and your Kenda and people like that, they're all almost uniformly convinced that socialism is unreformable, which prompts the question, what the hell are you doing there then? And also just, so can you contrast the Eastern Europeans and the Chinese? Because first of all, they come off very differently in your book, in your account, than they do, say, in Julian Gwertz's. But interesting, though. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So I actually managed to meet the last Eastern European participant of that conference who was still alive during my interviews. And I met him in Paris. And ironically, when he showed up, he was wearing the exact same outfit as he was wearing in the picture.
Yeah, you noted that in the book. That's very funny.
Why am I telling that anecdote in response to your question?
Because his economic life didn't improve that much.
his economic life did improve. He did emphasize that this trip to China was one of the most well-paid engagements he had ever undertaken. More importantly and more to the point, he preserved that outfit and he illustrated to me something that hadn't been clear to me before that interview, which was that from his perspective, going to China was an extremely bold thing to do, and which has to do probably with the relatively high honorarium by standards of the time and his own income standards, for the reason that he thought that if he had returned to his native Hungary, he would have been arrested pretty much upon entering the country. So there is a Chinese communist government that is inviting people who are emigres and who perceive themselves as dissidents in the sense that they would be arrested upon return to their own socialist country. So this is an extremely bold move. From the perspective of the Eastern Europeans, the reform attempts up to that date had basically been a series of failure. This is in their own description of what had happened. Yeah. So what they were trying to do was to come up with one big blueprint, one holistic solution that would change the system as a whole and would thereby achieve the creation of a market economy. So they had arrived at a logic of package reform, as it so were, that tried to solve the problems that they hadn't solved in what they thought of as gradualist reforms in the previous decades in pretty much one big go. In contrast, the Chinese counterparts were again and again emphasizing that they were facing enormous macroeconomic pressures, that they even had difficulties adjusting the relative price between synthetic and cotton textiles, that they were trying to enliven the system by introducing some flexibility at the margins and so on. So you have this contrast between the Eastern Europeans who are trying to find a holistic solution for system reform in the sense of change of the whole system based on one big blueprint, and these Chinese economists and officials who go on and on and on all these detailed questions of what seem rather small steps of reform. Then after the Morganshan World Bank conference, the World Bank delegation actually toured China, and they also went to the countryside, and the Eastern European emigres were entirely surprised by seeing how successful the agricultural reforms were. So whereas they had constantly advised against the dual track system during that conference, they were completely struck by seeing what they thought of as major progress in reform of a kind that they had not expected based on the evaluation of the experiences in their own countries. So that kind of resulted in a situation where it wasn't quite clear anymore what to take away from the Eastern European advice.
Point out that it was mostly, I mean, there were Anglo-American advisors too. I mean, Alec Cairncross, who's British, and John Kenneth Galbraith, who's American. They were actually, you know, quite supportive of the gradualist approach, as they had been in their own experience transitioning the war economies, right? So it's the contrast, though, with the Eastern Europeans is striking.
Yes. So just to be sure, Kenneth Galbraith was in China, actually the second delegation of economists after the Nixon visit, after the one of radical economists that I had mentioned before. His writings were around in the 80s. He himself did not make any prominent visits that showed up in the debates, but there were references being made to his writings. In terms of Alec Cairncross, he participated in the Ba Shan Lun boat conference, and he was someone who was involved in the post-war transition in the UK, which was in contrast to the West German transition and in contrast to the American transition, a very gradualist kind of transition, where the idea was that one would only liberalize prices for which supply was no longer falling vastly short of demand. Under the Labour government in the 40s and early 50s, the approach of transition was in some sense gradualist in a somewhat similar way to what the Chinese have been doing in the 1980s. On top of it, Cairncross was pointing out that it would be very dangerous to implement rapid reforms, and that and this was, by the way, also a point that was made by James Tobin, that China's banking system was not developed enough to replace direct price controls with indirect macroeconomic controls.
Let's get into this. I think it's a very fascinating part of your book about generations and how the different actors in China's early days of reform, when they were born and their formative experiences, seem to correlate so much with their position on the question of how to reform. What was the basis for this alliance that seems to have formed between young intellectuals who had been sent down to the countryside and older officials who had maybe, you know, been active in the revolution itself and had been in the base areas. This group was so instrumental in championing gradualism and in China's escape from shock therapy. So, and who were they up against, and what was sort of the formative experiences and the demographics of those people?
Yeah, at that point, I would actually like to give a shout out to Liu Hong, whose book from 2010, which has only been published in Chinese so far, I think has been an incredibly valuable source both for Julian as well as for my own book. So I just want to make sure that people are also aware of Liu Hong's work. She has done a tremendous amount of research in chronicling the stories of the economists of the 1980s. And I think it's probably not wrong to say that both Julian and I would have struggled incredibly without being able to rely on the enormous groundwork that she has done. And she also introduces this concept of generations. So I think there is a certain pattern that emerges. Of course, we have to be careful in overstretching these generational divides. Sure. and creating a sense of monolithic generations. But I think there is a certain pattern, which is that the revolutionary generation of leaders who have gone through the struggles of economic warfare and who were directly or indirectly involved in the post-liberation economic reconstruction project and the ways in which the Communist Party and state then used the market as a tool. So that generation of leaders and the young generation of intellectuals that really emerged through the agricultural reforms, who were so-called sent down youth during the Cultural Revolution and had often spent from their teens to their mid-20s in very poor villages and were as such intimately familiar with the living conditions and the political economy of agriculture in China. And when they returned to the cities, and in particular returned to Beijing for those who then came to join the Nongfazu, the agricultural development group, they did not forget about the countryside when they returned, right? Sure. Similarly, for that first generation of leaders, the countryside, of course, was incredibly important already in the revolutionary struggles. So there is a certain connection via the dedication to the countryside and the political economy of agriculture and the question of agricultural reform. On the other hand, there are what by the 80s would have been more or less middle-aged, often economists, as in trained as economists, who were trained in the 50s and 60s and were often trained in a relatively orthodox kind of Soviet style of economics, who then formed an alliance with young researchers who often had a background in engineering and the sciences and who were focused on questions of system design, cybernetics, and all of that. So you had that alliance of formerly orthodox Soviet economists who turned more or less neoclassical, where there is quite some intellectual overlap between certain kinds of Soviet economics and neoclassical economics, together with these young scientists who were acquiring the latest techniques in maths and computer science and so on.
So these are the battle lines that are drawn. These are the forces that are arrayed against each other. And it's this battle of 1986, which you detail in chapter 7 of your book, which I think is one of the big moments of drama. You've talked a little bit about the forces that are arrayed against one another. You know, people arguing still for preserving the dual track system on the one hand to cross the river by feeling for stones, and others that were, you know, for the Big Bang package reforms. People like, Wu Jinglian. The character, though, that emerges as the most difficult to read, and this is not just in your account, but in all these other accounts, it's hard to get a sense of Zhao Ziyang, who was at the time the premier. What role does he play in these debates? It's because it's very contested. The accounts in his own Prisoner of the State, they just do not square with what many of your interview subjects say. And those interview subjects don't necessarily agree with one another either. How do you approach this contested legacy, and how do you come out of it? What's your read on this mysterious figure of Zhao Ziyang?
So I think that Zhao Ziyang is an incredibly important figure of the 1980s and is probably a somewhat conflicted figure. I mean, he seems to be taking these questions extraordinarily seriously, but as one of his secretaries was saying in an interview, he would be approaching these discussions in the fashion in which he had later experienced graduate seminars at an American university. So there was always an openness to discuss both sides and to very seriously consider both sides and to really engage with the arguments that both sides were presenting. And I think this was in some sense his strength and his weakness, in that it probably would have been very hard to carve out that very distinct approach to reform that emerged in China without a leader that had that open-mindedness. At the same time, this resulted in him being torn between different approaches again and again, and also kind of moving from one side to the other, and thereby creating a certain tension. And then, of course, in terms of the interpretation of his legacy, I think this can be hardly disentangled from the political interests of those who themselves were involved in the 1980s. So that makes it even more complicated to understand what exactly happened. And I think,
but be more explicit about that. What do you mean exactly? What are these battling political interests?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Zhao Ziyang Wenji, which is an incredibly important and incredibly useful resource, and I'm using it a lot in the book. At the same time, it's quite striking how some of the people who clearly were important in the 1980s, by all accounts, including those who were battling with them, hardly figure in the Zhao Ziyang Wenji. So clearly the documents that would have been attributed to them didn't make it in there. I don't know what the editorial process was. It might be that they were just not part of the conversation and therefore their documents didn't make it into this volume. But it does, of course, present a picture that is not entirely balanced in that it privileges certain kinds of interactions over others. So that is what I mean when I say that the history of the 1980s is still, in some sense, the ways in which it is written is still a reflection of who is talking to whom and who has access to what kind of publishers and all of that.
Speaking of who talking to who,
that might be still too obscure, right?
the figure that doesn't get talked about a lot in your study is the person who was general secretary at the time up until his removal in 1987. And that's, of course, Hu Yaobang. Where did he fit into the debate? I mean, where did he stand and why is he kind of absent? I mean, you know, there, if you look at the index of your book, he's mentioned on 6 pages maybe, but in passing, there's never really a discussion of how he felt about all this.
Yeah, I think that Hu Yaobang was really important in bringing up this young generation of reform intellectuals. And I am writing about this in the book, maybe not extensively as I should have, but already in 1971, so already before the Nixon visit, Hu is being recollected as someone who had an open door and who invited young people in his vicinity to join a discussion over the political economy of agriculture, the questions of reform, what kind of approach was needed. And in particular, Chen Yizi, who of course emerges as the director of the TGISU, of the Economic System Reform Research Institute, he basically does rise to influence because of Hu Yaobang's support, right?
So I see.
He meets Hu Yaobang still during the Cultural Revolution. Chen Yizi had been sent to the countryside after he wrote a letter to Mao Zedong, criticizing that there was a lack of democracy. And then it spends several years in Henan, and it gets engaged in all sorts of agricultural education projects and even becomes a local cadre, and still during the Cultural Revolution is someone who is very actively thinking about how the political economy of agriculture could be reorganized. And in that context...
Yeah, so I mean, Chen Yizi, he's kind of the prototype of that one faction you're talking about, that, you know, he is very much arguing for preserving dual track for now, gradualism, you know, 摸着石头过河, which comes up again. I love that expression.
In fact, Hu Yaobang is the one who calls Chen Yizi back to Beijing in 1978 and gives him a position at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and the Agricultural Institute, and basically supports him in his initiatives to start these survey works of the initial experiments in the countryside. Now, why does Hu Yaobang not play as prominent a role in the subsequent chapters of the book? It's not to make him disappear. That is not at all the intention.
No, but my
focus is really on the day-to-day questions of economic reform, and the responsibility for these day-to-day questions of economic reform were primarily in the hands of Zhao Ziyang in his position as premier. So when Zhao Ziyang then later on himself becomes general secretary, he actually also loses the direct control over the day-to-day decision-making or the day-to-day discussions, most high-level discussions on economic reform. So it's really because of the position that he occupies that he's less directly involved in these specific discussions over how to design the next step in economic reform compared to Zhao Ziyang. But he has been incredibly critical in nourishing the rural development group, and as such nourishing really that third force, if you want so, in China's reform discourse of the 1980s.
Fair enough. So, I mean, we'll fast forward a little bit through the debate of 1986. I mean, the upshot is that the protagonists, if you will, of in your book prevail in 86. But and there's all sorts of really interesting reasons why, and you go through the different arguments that they make and the different sort of fact-finding missions. You know, they go to Yugoslavia and they, you know, at the behest of Soros, to Hungary and to Yugoslavia, and I think they come back and they cable back very skeptical about the possibility of shock. And they also, you know, learn, I think, more details about what happened really at the Earhart Miracle. But we'll leave all those details for now and move to the next big battle, which is 1988. And the two competing theories about the root causes for inflation in 87 and especially 1988. It seems like both sides in this are guilty of some motivated reasoning. I mean, they both blame inflation on the other side's policy prescriptions, you know, in the very much the same way that they divided in 86. So this is really consequential here. I mean, what it matters because, of course, inflation seems to have been such an important factor in bringing people into the streets. So, but Isabella, maybe you can help me understand this better, because it's something that's always kind of nagged me about 88. Now, the students and intellectuals who supported package reforms, you know, they were very much in the full steam ahead camp. They don't seem to have wrestled, though, with the irony that inflation, which I think many people would attribute to their specific policy orientation, to their support of, you know, price liberalization, they were able to use inflation as a mobilizational tool for the movement to bring people into the street when the very policies they had kind of supported, you know, hit the gas, don't hit the brakes, hit the gas, plow through the barrier. That was what was giving rise to inflation. Now, of course, there's the other side which says, no, that's not what was giving rise to inflation. But how do they square this? How, you've talked to many participants in 89. How do they talk about this?
Yeah, I think it's useful to very briefly back up and talk about 86, because I think in 86, it still was some sort of economics debate over evaluating different forms of reform. And the dual-track people basically warning that if one was to liberalize the prices of essential upstream producer goods too quickly, that this would unleash cost push inflation, very much of the same kind as we are talking about these days with commodity prices going through the roof. So in 1988, I think the situation was very different from 86, in the sense that in 88, reform itself had reached a certain impasse, and the situation started to become quite chaotic. And also Deng Xiaoping himself took initiative, who, unlike Zhao Ziyang, I think was not the kind of person who could be convinced by economic arguments once he had set his mind to a certain action. So in 1988, it became clear that reform, unlike the first years had suggested, did not stand to benefit everybody, but that some would be not only benefiting more, but that some would also actually be losing from reform. And that the gradual dismantling of the communes did not only have benefits for the agricultural population. It was the first time that urban-rural incomes were actually diverging. So a pretty deep tension was building up in the system where the downsides of marketization and the social harshness of marketization started to become apparent.
Right.
So in that context, the so-called conservatives were starting to become more virulent, arguing against reform. And Deng Xiaoping, I think, to some extent saw his back against the wall and kind of tried to rescue the legacy of reform, trying to push ahead in a context that was already inflationary. And that initial inflationary context was probably due to the dual track system, because if you think about it and you have a situation where certain goods are in very short supply and they are being traded on the market at market prices, then they would have very high prices. And these prices were much, much, much higher than the planned prices. So a certain inflationary tendency was built into the dual track system. The argument of the dual track reformers was that it was less severe than letting go of all prices because the shortages don't go away. So if you just say, okay, it's all free prices, then inflation would be worse than if you have the dual track system where part of the prices were state controlled. But nevertheless, there was an inflationary tendency that was not least unleashed by certain liberalizations of consumer goods that seemed minor but turned out quite important, such as certain types of alcohol, cigarettes, and so on.
Right, right.
So in that context, Deng Xiaoping takes the initiative and says we have to crush through the gate of price reform. Now, those who were in favor of package reform actually thought that you first had to have austerity and macroeconomic restraint before you could do Big Bang, right?
Right.
Those who were against Big Bang thought you shouldn't do Big Bang whether you did austerity or not. And now Deng Xiaoping takes the initiative towards a Big Bang in a situation where even the Big Bang supporters were thinking you would have to have first austerity, right? And I think this quote-unquote irrationality has to be seen in the context of this already enormous tensions that we're building up within the system. So to answer your question more directly about 1989, I'm not so sure if it's so straightforward that the protesters were unanimously in favor of package
crashing through
reform. Yeah. I think we have to remember that rapid price rises in situations of deep political tensions have unleashed very far-ranging protests in all sorts of contexts, right? I mean, most prominently in history, of course, the French Revolution, but also the Arab Spring was not least triggered by the rapid rise of the price of bread, the yellow vests in France, which of course ended up being much less consequential than the Arab Spring, were triggered by the increase of the price for gas, right? So this pattern of price rises that hit people hard because they affect their consumption patterns very directly, unleashing or being a trigger for much bigger protests, I think is one that is not at all unique to China. And that I think it's of course, I'm not arguing 1989 is just another bread riot. But I think if you ask me about the relationship between them foregrounding inflation and at the same time, also agreeing with the need to push ahead, then I think part of it is this trigger effect of rises in important prices that have the potential to unleash movement. So my point is that I don't think that the protesters had some kind of scheme where they were using inflation in order to protest, but then actually wanted something that was inconsistent with this, but rather that the inflationary dynamic and then...
I'm not saying it was deliberate, but... I would say what's interesting is that you could make the same argument with corruption, that the inherent price disparities in a dual track system were, you know, it laid the groundwork for, I mean, it was too inviting that corruption was inevitable there. And so also, you know, I think a lot of people would say that it was these gradualists and their insistence on maintaining the dual track system that made it possible for these levels of corruption that were then, you know, used instrumentally, you know, to bring people into the streets and to mobilize people by the students and their intellectual backers.
Yeah.
So yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, I think just to be sure, I think that corruption is extremely important, and that it probably was underestimated by the dual track people, just how explosionary the corruption tendencies that were unleashed by that system were.
For sure, for sure. I want to ask you a question sort of going forward here. I mean, so Guo Shuqing, who now heads the CBRC, the China Banking Regulatory Commission, and Lo Jiwei, who was the Minister of Finance from, I think, like, up until 2016. I think it was during the first term of Xi Jinping. These guys were all, back then, advocates of package reform. Like we said, we've seen sort of the winners were the ones, after 89, who were the ones on the side of package reform. They all ended up in very powerful positions. What do they say now? I mean, looking back on the battles of the 80s, is there some consensus maybe that, hey, you know, Li Ning and Chen Yizi were actually right? They're not ardent market liberalizers anymore, necessarily.
Yeah, I think we have to distinguish between their positions today and their interpretation of the 1980s. I think as regards the 1980s, Luo Jiwei has possibly been the most outspoken one, who gave a speech in 2017 where he basically argued again that the problem in 88 was not the attempt to pursue very comprehensive and fast price reforms, but that the problem was basically that not enough macroeconomic restraint was in place, which is exactly the argument
that's in your book, I remember,
of 1988. At the same time, I think we have to also see that Luo Jiwei or Guo Shuqing in 2021 is not the same person as in the 1980s.
Sure.
I mean, even in the American context, if someone would have told you that Joe Biden would be the one who promotes large-scale public investments like some 3 years ago, one probably wouldn't really have believed it, right? So I think we have to see that in China as elsewhere, politicians who are in the system for so long are also being shaped by the system in their own attitudes.
So did the divisions between the package reform camp and the gradualists, did they endure, and did they manifest themselves later in the factional divisions that we saw in later decades, like in the aughts, for example? Because it's tempting for me to draw a line from the, you know, package reform guys to the Shanghai clique, you know, during the era of Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji, because they are still the sort of same, very neoliberal, pro free trade, pro coastal development, pro FDI. I think that, and then the gradualists, do they kind of evolve into I don't like using this shorthand necessarily, but the Communist Youth League faction, people who are more concerned with rural development, still more concerned with the growing, you know, unbalanced economic growth and the inequalities. Is there a line to be drawn there?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the direct mapping, but I think as a general principle, it is the case that the struggle between two different ways of thinking about reform continues throughout the 90s, even though most of the dual-track reformers of the 80s, of course, disappear from the scene, since in 1989, they stand loyal with Zhao Ziyang, and they actually issue a statement arguing for the need for dialogue between the protesters and the leadership, and thereby supporting the demand of the protesters. And therefore, most of them actually ended up in exile, if not in prison, or basically withdrew into private business or into relatively insignificant positions. So it is not a continuity in terms of the precise persons, but in terms of the struggles that evolve in the 90s, I think there is a continuity. And I think that to some degree, that is inherent in the dual track system, because the dual track by its very nature leaves open the possibility of more radical reforms, as well as the possibility of strengthening the state side of the system, right? And in the 1990s, the big struggle is, of course, the struggle over state-owned enterprise reform. And in that context, someone like Wu Jinglian does make another appearance. So in 1995, Jiang Zemin switches to the whole slogan of doing a good job with the whole state-owned sector should now be grasping the big and letting go the small, which is then the big slogan.
Very light and heavy again.
Yeah, which is completely heavy and light. I mean, it's completely heavy and light, but it is pushing the boundary of reform quite drastically and saying we have to not only have all state-owned enterprises grow into the market, but rather we have to give up on the small state-owned enterprises, right? Which is extending the same logic, but in a renewed radical step. Now, in that context, a new struggle emerged over how much privatization, how much of GDP should be under state ownership and all of that. And there was, for example, the 10,000 Chinese characters manifesto, the Wanyanshu, which articulated the position that having a quote-unquote socialist state without having significant or majority state ownership would be a contradiction and would be betraying socialism. And in this context, in 1997, Wu Jinglian is again mobilized and leads a commission under the Development Research Center under the State Council, presenting counter arguments why state-owned enterprise reform has to continue. So in that sense, these struggles continue and they do involve some of the same people. But I think it's the continuation of a sort of two logics that are ingrained in the process of reform and that are re-emerging again and again at the different junctures. And I think that basically we can think of the Big Bang side in the 90s and 2000s as the side that is, and to some extent until today, the side that is calling for completing reforms. So if you think that reforms are not complete, then you think that this mixed system that has emerged is not a system that can continue in that form, but instead that it has, that marketization has to be completed, meaning working towards the separation of state and market in all its facets and finance and so on. Whereas if you think that state market participation in itself is a mode of governance, then there's of course a need to continue reform and to redefine the system and so on, but there's no such thing as completing the reform for good and separating the state and the market for good in some sense.
So that continues to be, I think, a live tension in Chinese thinking. But I think what you argued in your book well is that China did escape, if not just shock therapy, it also escaped binary thinking on shock therapy, on, you know, the kind of thinking that says free market good, planned economy bad. But this kind of binary thinking still seems to have a grip on many people who study China, where there's this instinct that so many of us have, and I'm sure I've been guilty of it too, where we just hear, well, this guy is a champion of free markets, of market liberalization, therefore I root for him or her, and it's too often him, but then the other side, you know, oh, this person is kind of in the, you know, 国进民退 kind of camp, and therefore they're bad. You know, anyone who's defending state-owned enterprises or anything like that, oh, they're bad. What do you say to people who still frame things this way? Because I feel like that's a pernicious tendency still.
Yeah. Thanks for this question. I would like to insert one comment on the 90s and then get to that. So just to be sure, my point is not that in the 1990s and 2000s, there weren't very wide-ranging and very harsh policies that are chronicled, for example, by Qinquan Li's work, the dismantling of the Rust Belt and all of that. So the point is not that there haven't been very wide-ranging, very harsh social policies and economic liberalizations, but my point is that there hasn't been shock therapy in the ways in which I have defined it in the book. I just wanted to put this out there because this sometimes has caused some confusion. To your broader question of how can we think beyond the binary of free market versus planning, or how are we often caught up in that binary? I think it's quite ironic that on the part of those who have been cheering for free markets and, if you want, so neoliberalism, they have often projected free market policies on China's reforms. So from their perspective, China's reform success is all a miracle of freeing up the market potential. Whereas on the left, right. those who think that China has gone too far and that China has become too capitalist, they often ironically arrive at a similar conclusion, where they then think that China has become neoliberal, which they see as a critical term, but nevertheless, which basically confirms the idea that it's all been about free marketism, right? So what I'm trying to do with this book is to challenge us to see beyond equating neoliberalism with marketization, but to see that marketization can take very different forms, and that marketization itself, the process of marketization, the forms of marketization, they're fiercely contested, and that China's process of marketization deserves study in its own right, rather than simply being subsumed under one label or another.
Isabel, that's just so fantastic. And thank you so much for joining me today. I mean, I've said before on this program, let me just close with a couple of thoughts I have about after finishing your book. I've said on this program before that in my own dealings with economists who work on China, I find that there's this spectrum along which they tend to fall, this continuum where on one extreme, and I guess I haven't really met, I mean, this is, of course, a straw man, but, you know, there are people who think that China's economy is completely sui generis. These people would say that the concepts that are taught to us in our economics courses, they have neither any descriptive nor any prescriptive value when it comes to China. But on the other extreme, you have people who say that China is just no different at all, that it's subject to exactly the same ironclad laws of economics as the rest of the world. So it doesn't matter, I've used this phrase before, whether it's Chile or Chad or China that you're talking about, it's all the same. And I feel like, having finished this book, I've come away with a much better sense of what actually does make China significantly different. So that when I now hear that, you know, hackneyed expression, socialist market economy with Chinese characteristics, I actually know what the socialist part is, what the market part is, and I think most importantly, what the Chinese characteristics are. So thank you for this wonderful book. I just cannot recommend it more highly. I hope that everyone reads it. I'm so glad that it's being talked about so widely, though.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for these great questions. This has been really, really fun discussing these important junctures of the 80s with you. Thank you.
Likewise, let's get to recommendations. before we do that, I want to quickly remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you like the work we're doing with Seneca and with all the other shows in the Seneca network, the best way to help us out is to subscribe to SubChina Access, our daily email newsletter. It's produced by my colleagues Lucas and Jeremy, and it's just fantastic. Please subscribe. That really, really helps. These things do cost money. So, on to recommendations. Isabella, what do you have for us?
So, I would like to recommend the 1950 movie Rashomon by Kurosawa, which is the story of different perspectives on a murder. And during my interviews and while trying to make sense of the fierce struggles, really, amongst reformers in the 1980s, that movie to some extent has been a compass in trying to take every side seriously and on their own account.
I actually wrote a question in here that I didn't get to. I mean, when we were talking about Julian Gewirtz's book, I mean, I felt like it was Rashomon. I mean, I actually wrote the word Rashomon, and I thought, I wonder if all of our listeners will understand what I mean. But oh my God, how weird that you thought of the same. Ah, oh, that's crazy.
I mean, it is really, yeah, Rashomon. Yeah, it was. The 80s in China is Rashomon. So, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's a completely different perspective, especially the 88. I mean, when you get to the 88 inflation and the arguments over that, it was, people are looking at the same set of facts and drawing such completely different conclusions and, you know, telling the facts so differently. Wow, that's fantastic. A great recommendation.
Well, I'm really glad that the Rashomon effect came through in the book so that it made you think of that movie.
Yeah, I mean, if there's two things you need to know before you go in, know what Rashomon is and know what Jenga is.
I mean, I actually have one more recommendation, which is...
Which
is the movie, the Polish movie Cold War, which is, I think, a really, really amazing piece of art, but also just stands out for trying to portray both Paris in that case and Poland during the Cold War in, I think, a very realistic way, neither demonizing nor romanticizing either side of the Cold War. And it's a love story where at the end the two lovers are so torn apart by the Cold War that they don't see another exit but suicide. So I think this is an incredibly powerful movie that kind of makes one think in the current context.
I'm looking at it right now. It looks really good. This is a 2018 film.
That's right. Yeah. It was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed it. But do you know if it's seeable somewhere on one of the, like on Sundance?
I think it's available on Amazon Prime.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
I mean, I just really love the realism of it. And I feel that we can learn from trying to work towards a realistic assessment of both sides and in the mounting tensions.
Great. So mine is not so much a recommendation as a signed greeting for Cynical listeners who want to get a jump on a show that we're going to be recording in a week. So it will probably be out at the end of July, still within the month, the correct month of the centenary of the Chinese Communist Party. And it is about the Chinese Communist Party. It's a book called The Chinese Communist Party, A Century in 10 Lives. And it's edited by three very eminent China scholars, including one of them who is going to be our guest, Timothy Cheek. I promise that at least one of the others will be brought onto the show as a guest soon. I'm talking to you, Klaus. But Timothy Cheek and Elizabeth Perry will be joining us on the show, as well as our very own Jeremy Goldcorn, who wrote the chapter on the Naughty Aughties, which is totally appropriate if you know Jeremy. Really great book, and I encourage you all to read it so that you'll get a better sense of what we're talking about when we do the show. Once again, Isabella, what a pleasure. What a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, it was so edifying. This book was... Thank you for writing it.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and how nice to meet you.
Yeah, indeed. Look forward to seeing you at AAS conferences.
Yes, Hawaii, we come.
I can't wait. Yes. I'm going to go.
Yeah.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcord, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.